parting on the left, and now they're parting on the right. And the beards have all grown longer overnight. And I tip my hat to the new constitution, take a bow for the new revolution, smile and grin at the changes all around. Pick up my guitar and play just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees and pray.
As Richie Havens sings it, let's get down on our knees this week. Elections, financial crisis, bailouts, energy, and still that climate disruption. It's election fever in the United States and Canada, and I'll bet we do get fooled again.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hi there. Thanks for tuning in. This week we'll start with the big bang on Wall Street as the banksters clean out the piggy bank. We have an interview with the People's Reporter, Mike Whitney. Then we'll bridge out to the ugly ways the finance crisis is being used as a corporate club to beat back efforts to save our climate, even in Europe. But there are some intelligent people working to bring real change. We'll hear a couple of clips from the U.S. Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, where Representative Ed Markey is leading the charge to invest at least $100 billion in real green energy instead of shipping your gas payments off to semi-hostile governments overseas. And young people are getting involved. To get climate change back into the elections, we have an interview with Brianna K. O'Cotter of the American Power Vote Movement in the U.S. From Canada, we have a rousing speech from Zipporah Berman as environmental groups launch Power Up Canada. Both groups want to bring in young voters demanding real action for a stable climate. We may have a little fun along the way, including election advice from the late great comedian George Carlin. In fact, let's get started with what you all want to hear about. Will we have any pensions or money in the bank next week?
No, but you're thinking of this place all wrong, as if I had the money back in a safe. The money's not here.
Six times OU has had to punt this evening.
Dad, we need to talk. Can you turn down the TV? This is important. No, it can't wait. I'm in big trouble, Dad. I've been gambling with some guys downtown. I lost everything. I was stupid, and I bet money I didn't have. These are tough guys, Dad. They're going to take me down unless I come up with the money tonight. These guys are waiting outside right now. I have to pay them right now. I need 7,000 bucks, or this will be the last time you ever see me. Here's your checkbook. Sign it, please, Dad. Repayment? Come on! We're talking about a dead man walking here. We'll work out all these details later. Don't worry, don't worry. I'll get it all back to you. Oh, yeah, sure. Well, it's a blank check. You never know with these guys. I may have to pay them more than seven big ones. They might say it's interest or whatever. I have to pay up right now. They're waiting outside. Just sign the bleeping check, Dad, or they may come in and get you, too.
Looking for that landmark road win increases the lead in front of a stunned house here.
Well, they started up front and gave him a different look. Greg Schiano, we were wondering what he'd do, you know, and he tried to dial up a different defense.
What is going on here is terrible, it's unexcusable, and we need to deal with it. But that is going to take some time to figure that out and do it carefully and well.
From Washington State, freelance writer Mike Whitney has become the People's Reporter on the financial crisis. Mike, thanks for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
Well, before we get going to the crowning of King Paulson and the trillion-dollar bailout of the banksters, I'd like to go back one step to an interview you published with Michael Hudson. You explained how the need to pump up the value of U.S. property was actually driven by the deficit spending on wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Can you explain how that cycle worked?
Well, I believe we traced it all back to the monetary policies of the Federal Reserve, if that's what you're talking about. In the present case, of course, this current bailout is going to cost three times the amount of the Iraq war thus far, and it's looking like it could cost twice that. But, of course, after the dot-com bust, Between 2002 and 2005, for 31 consecutive months, the Federal Reserve produced low-interest money that was below the face value of the dollar via their interest rates, which they kept, which they drove all the way down to 1%, which put trillions of dollars of low-interest money into the system and allowed this enormous housing bubble, which the economist calls the biggest equity bubble in history, to develop. And, of course, they monitored it the whole time when it went from the retail value of property went from $10 trillion in 2000 to $22 trillion by 2006. So they knew exactly what was happening. It was much the same as the dot-com bubble, people selling worthless things at exorbitant prices. And that's the equivalent of basically asset inflation that's caused by low-interest money. And the Federal Reserve typically uses this as a way to shift wealth from one class to another. Now, if I'm not mistaken, in approximately year 2000, 1% of 30% of the wealth of the United States was controlled by 37% of the people. Now that has shifted to roughly 52% of the wealth of the country is controlled by 1%. So there's been an enormous shift in a polarization in the country, and that's the result of very conscious and deliberate monetary policy by the Federal Reserve.
But in order to cycle the money back that they had spent on this war, they had to have something to go down and hawk at the pawn shop, and they sold these derivatives based on marvelous American property. And it's questionable whether they could have even financed that war without this property boom, is what I was getting from your earlier interview.
Well, yeah, exactly. Look at what happened after the Clinton administration. We have a country that was run very strictly by the rule of law. The foreign countries believed that we had markets that were fairly sufficiently regulated, and we had a budget deficit which was it had moved into surplus. So we were in a very strong position to attract foreign capital. So when we started this circular flow of money, which comes from currency deregulation, and our current account deficit rose to $800 billion a year, the money, which means that we were consuming $800 billion more than we were spending. And that money was being attracted to U.S. security treasuries and to bonds and securities in the stock market. And as it turns out, the stock market didn't have enough to sell them to attract foreign capital, so they started developing these complex derivatives like mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations and the whole alphabet soup of these things to attract foreign capital. And, of course, the people in the foreign capitals, the foreign banks, insurance companies, and investors overseas who now control $6 trillion of U.S. dollar-backed assets thought that these were safe because they assumed they were dealing with a trustworthy partner. And as it turns out, they're utterly worthless. And that's why the American taxpayer is expected to pick up the tab for it now.
Well, you know, Americans have been told repeatedly there's no money for schools, for health care, for green jobs, from alternative energy. But no, it turns out we can create $1 trillion of debt any old time if Wall Street needs it.
We've been promised, for the last 7 years in the Bush administration that there's not going to be any new taxes, but people should understand that in its current form, this bailout, if it's $700 billion, and I presume it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $2 trillion, if it's $700 billion, every man, woman, and child overnight just got a tax increase of $2,000, okay? If it's $1.5 trillion, then you're looking at a tax increase for every man, woman, and child of $4,000. So, in fact, even though we're delaying payment because we're increasing the national deficit, essentially doubling it since Bush took office. When Clinton left office, it was $5.9 trillion, and by the time Bush leaves office, it will be $11.5 trillion. So he's essentially doubled it. He's he's expanded the government by 30%. He's increased defense spending from $400 billion to $600 billion. I believe the new defense budget is about $613 billion. And he has created enormous debts, which the next generation will have to pay.
Well, that's kind of the Bush administration. They say, give us the biggest blank check in the world and trust us. And by the way, you can never trace this either through government or through the courts. It sounds like the billions that disappeared into the Iraq war. You know, from the outside, Mike, this just looks like a last-minute kind of pre-election coup. The Bush gang stops to loot the last of the imaginary treasury as they go out the door. Is that what's happening here?
You know, it really is, because there's two things we should keep in mind. Is first of all, that what happened and the fact that loans, mortgages were sold to people without any of the standard criteria for loaning money, which is to say that people did not have to prove their income, did not have to prove they had collateral, they didn't have to put the standard down payment, did not get locked into fixed 30-year loans, that the reason those rules were swept away is because they knew to pass these on to investors around the world, and they were fraudulently represented as being solid loans and solid mortgages. And, of course, people in foreign countries believe that. But so the fact that these were fraudulent to begin with, we know that. There has been no talk of accountability whatsoever. So, yes, are these people just trying to throw a Hail Mary pass to get the money? But the money that they get out of this is going to wipe their debts clean. But what are they going to do with it? They're not going to do it to try to redevelop industry in the United States, because the consumer is having another $1 trillion added to his balance sheet, and he's already maxed out on his car loans, his mortgage loans, his everything else. The American consumer is more underwater than at any time in history. So what are they going to do with this? Well, Michael Hudson suggests that they're going to move it, do the same thing the Russian oligarchs did in the 90s. They're going to move their money that they get from the Federal Reserve overseas into hard assets, into foreign bank accounts offshore, so that they can, you know, take advantage of the growing markets in those areas, because the American market is done.
We're talking with Mike Whitney. His articles appear regularly in the online magazine Counterpunch, and then fan out almost infinitely, it seems to me, into the internet. Well, it's a strange new world, Mike. We never know what we'll wake up to tomorrow. How serious do you think this finance crisis is?
I think essentially they are loading the boats, and they've carved themselves out a silver canoe, and they're headed for foreign shores. And the same people who basically drove the economy into the ground are the people who are being rewarded for doing so. This is their second set of rewards, because, of course, they were paid lavishly on the front end when they were extorting this money from insurance companies and investors around the world. Now they're getting rewarded again for having done that. You know, to say that people are outraged is, I think, an understatement. But it does show how the media works in lockstep with the people who are in power. And the people who are in power, I mean, the curtain has been ripped off, because now we can see that, you know, Bush only holds a very subsidiary role to the bankers who have their stranglehold on the economy. And basically, he was pushed aside so this thing could move forward. He's had very little effect on this. But one thing that's kind of interesting that in the last few days, the Fed has actually been withdrawing liquidity from the system to create the appearance of a crisis. And I think that's to add pressure. The TED spread and LIBOR are at unprecedented high rates, which means that there's a breakdown of interbank lending. And that sounds all very, I don't know, esoteric to people who may be listening, but the truth of the matter is that the Fed is contributing to the atmosphere of crisis to push their legislation through. To say the Fed is not a political organization that is working in opposition to the interests of the American people is just to be deluded.
It's almost beyond comprehension. My understanding is the gross product of the world might be around $50 trillion, but various companies, including the AIG insurance giant that was just taken over by the government, have over $400 trillion of credit swaps and derivatives out there. How could this $700 billion or whatever it grows to be by Bush and Paulson even begin to hold back that coming flood of devaluation?
Well, you know, I've asked some of the smartest people around about that, and no one quite knows how those $700 trillion worth of counterparty swaps that you're talking about, derivatives, are going to unwind. You know, if just a small portion, like Bill Gross of PIMCO suggests, to say 2 or 3% of the credit default swaps, which amount $62 trillion, which is four times the amount of our, you know, yearly GDP, we're in big trouble. What I've been reading recently is that the reason that there's such urgency in this, you know, golden handshake that the investment banks and stuff are getting from Paulson is that there's a freeze in the credit default swaps market, which means that no matter what they do and how much money they pump into the system, there's going to be increased volatility and a rapid deflationary effects on the system. And I think Jack Welch, former head of General Electric, said something very, very similar to that yesterday, that we're headed for very hard times in the near term. So, and we saw that in the manufacturing numbers today and the housing numbers today and this number and that number. It gets progressively worse as the air keeps whooshing out of this enormous equity bubble.
I think everybody listening is saying, well, how is this going to affect me? How will this financial crisis impact the average working American? And will this solution, so-called, make it worse?
Well, I mean, what we should be doing very rapidly is we should be stepping in and on a regulatory basis. We should, you know, if like you said, we have $700 trillion of derivatives off balance sheets, essentially, and we can see now that those things create a clear and present danger to the broader economy. All of those things have to be regulated. And all of those things have to be capitalized in a way that it doesn't put all of the rest of us at risk. So the era of deregulation has to end immediately. Secondly, rather than putting the $700 billion into the pockets of the people who just fleeced us, we should put at least $500 billion of that into the FDIC, which is going to have to cover the over 300 or 400 banks that are going to go belly up because they're carrying a lot of these mortgage-backed securities on their balance sheets, and people expect to get their deposits, their life savings, and of course, their retirement back out of the banks. This is a very, very hairy situation because the reason they're pressing on this, there have already been what I would call digital bank runs. People have been taking their money. What happened last week when it wasn't just AIG, and it wasn't the folding up of Lehman Brothers. What happened is the fear spread through people who had money in money markets. They took over, it was something like $500 billion out in a matter of a few days out of the money market accounts. And the lubricant that keeps business going, which is commercial paper, essentially dried up. And basically banks were not doing deals with each other. And when the banks aren't providing credit to businesses and to consumers, the whole instruments of the economy shut down. And that's what happened, and that's what the fear was from. It wasn't simply Lehman and AIG. It's that we're very close to a situation of panic. And the government, as the Bush people are always wont to do, carve themselves a golden path outward, but they don't figure out anything for the people to do. And we need someone with some credibility to step forward, explain the situation to the American people, not like last night where you're just inciting panic, and show us the path forward is, which is not digging deeper and creating greater debt.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else you would like our listeners to know?
You know, there's no way around the fact that the media is now organized in a way to provide you with meaningless disinformation. I wish I had something more consoling to say, but if you're going to research this and you want to prepare yourself for what's coming ahead, you have to go to the Internet. You have to read guys like Market Ticker and Mish and Counterpunch and the other alternate sources for information, because literally your future depends on it.
Yeah, it's one big cheerleader chorus for Wall Street, it seems to me. Well, you've been listening to one of the few sane voices out there. Mike Whitney isn't paid by Goldman Sachs. He's a truly independent journalist who tracks the financial crisis. Mike, thank you for helping us understand.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Did you have a nightmare?
No, I'm worried about this family's financial future.
Does your retirement plan provide predictability of income and protection against market risk?
Do you have good supplemental health insurance?
What about estate planning? Car insurance? Dents are easy to fix, but liability's the nightmare.
Buddy, we're with AIG.
Oh.
The AIG companies, the strength to be there.
Don't get up. I'll talk myself in.
Many people are left with the impression that the current credit crisis that we're facing has been fueled by greedy investment bankers chasing profits and more so chasing bonuses. Is that fair?
It's about 90% accurate, I'm afraid. And in reality, there were a lot of people making money out of selling what amounted to, you know, rust heaps of cars, but they were called structured loans, to people for very high commissions. There wasn't a great ethical difference between dodgy seller of cars and dodgy seller of loans. A lot of it was driven by the greed of the banks and of the bankers individually.
Believe it or not, there are some politicians in Washington who know the climate threat. One is Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts, who chairs the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. Let's hear from the live webcast this week. Here is Ed Markey.
This hearing is called to order. The United States is in an economic tailspin. Earlier this week, Alan Greenspan characterized the situation as a once-in-a-century crisis and predicted that we are on the verge of recession. The markets are reeling. The Wall Street titans are collapsing, and home values have plummeted. Worst of all, for American families, unemployment has soared to its highest level in 5 years. With 84,000 jobs lost in August and 605,000 jobs lost since the beginning of this year. To set the economy right, we will have to take bold action on many fronts. We must restore oversight, transparency, and prudence in the financial markets. We must strengthen the dollar and reform our trade policy. And we must forge a new energy strategy, one that will finally release us from big oil's stranglehold, ignite an energy technology revolution, and put America back to work. Change, baby, change must be our mantra if we are going to successfully work to restore America to strength and prosperity. Speedy adoption of a green stimulus package is a crucial first step. A recent study from the Center for American Progress and the Political Economy Research Institute shows that by investing $100 billion in greening our buildings, expanding our mass transit, building a smart electrical grid, and supporting wind and solar power and advanced biofuels, we can create 2 million new jobs. The green investment package they propose creates more jobs, better-paying jobs, than they would at the same level of spending on consumer rebates. It creates four times as many jobs as the same level of investment in the oil and gas industry. At the same time, it will save American consumers billions in energy costs and slashing global warming pollution. In states all across the country, from California to Michigan and Ohio, the clean energy industry is already among the leaders in job creation. In my home state of Massachusetts, clean tech is already the 10th largest industry and is projected to grow to third in the next 10 years. Energy technology, or ET, as Thomas Friedman has called it, will rival IT as an engine of innovation and economic growth in the coming decades. All we need are the right policies to strike the spark. We have begun to make this change a reality by passing the Energy Independence and Security Act last December and the Comprehensive Energy Security and Consumer Protection Act earlier this week. The legislation passed in the House this week establishes a comprehensive energy policy that includes, among other things, tax credits for wind and solar power, a national renewable electricity standard, aggressive building efficiency standards, and increased funding for mass transit, green buildings, and home energy assistance for low-income households. Extending the renewable energy tax credits alone will save 116,000 American jobs and $19 billion in investment. We must now take the next step with a targeted set of investments that will put Americans back to work retrofitting our buildings to save energy, greening the grid, training workers for green jobs, and building the fuel-efficient cars of the future right here in America. These measures are a down payment on building America's energy economy. The future first steps towards economic recovery. These are those critical first steps. The greatest long-term challenges, however, are also going to be dealt with on at the same time. America's economy and national security, that is, freeing us from dependence on foreign energy sources and combating global warming. We have an excellent panel of witnesses who will be able to discuss all of these issues for us. We look forward to their testimony.
The committee heard Bracken Hendricks of the Center for American Progress and Dr. Robert Polin, the co-director of Political Economy Research Institute. They are leading the charge by many environmental groups to get a government kickstart for clean energy like wind, solar, and geothermal power. Unlike the Bush bailout of Wall Street, this plan would create real green jobs in America, help solve the balance of payments problem, reduce payments to possible terrorists, and reduce greenhouse gases. You can download the testimony of Bracken Hendricks and Dr. Robert Polin for green jobs from the Climate Solutions page at ecoshock.org. Just look for our audio on-demand menu. It's sad to report all the major media who are pushing governments to hand over taxpayer money to the banksters have the usual hacks saying, well, we can't afford to do anything about climate change right now. It gets even crazier than that. Here is 9/11 guru Webster Tarpley's weird explanation of the finance crisis.
We need a national austerity program. And Carter had always had this strongly pro austerity overtone in terms of his energy policies. And God knows with Obama, that is even stronger. Obama's the guy who says, you will not get enough to eat, you will not have the car you want, you will not have your thermostat at the level you desire because the rest of the world won't allow it. Well, the rest of the world, of course, means City of London parasitical financiers, the same people who backed Hitler and Mussolini to the hilt back in the 1930s, they don't like that because they're green and Malthusian zero-growth advocates these days. So,
broadcasting on right-wing radio talk shows, Webster Tarpley was for years the mouthpiece of Lyndon LaRouche, the fraudster who darkly campaigned for president time after time. It's more than the silly season. Even in Europe, the threat of shrinking finances and general voter disgust is threatening climate action. The Newswire AFP report, September 21st, bears the headline, Economic Crisis Threatens EU Measures on Climate Change. Business leaders are threatening further job cuts if carbon pricing remains. Anti-climate talk comes particularly from the southern members like Italy and Spain, whose economies have hit the skids. Hey, if human jobs are at stake, why not borrow from the next generation? We'll all be dead by the time rising seas flood the cities. Jobs come first. Jobs come first. Jobs come first. Did I say elections? Is that a big yawn? Here is comedian George Carlin's solution.
Politicians. Everybody complains about politicians. Everybody says they suck.
Yeah.
Well, where do people think these politicians come from? They don't fall out of the sky. They don't pass through a membrane from another reality. They come from American parents and American families, American homes, American schools, American churches, American businesses, and American universities, and they're elected by American citizens. This is the best we can do, folks. This is what we have to offer. It's what our system produces. Garbage in, garbage out. If you have selfish, ignorant citizens, you're going to get selfish, ignorant leaders. And term limits ain't going to do you any good. You're just going to wind up with a brand new bunch of selfish, ignorant Americans. So maybe it's not the politicians who suck. Maybe something else sucks around here. Like the public. Yeah, the public sucks. There's a nice campaign slogan for somebody. The public sucks. Fuck hope. Because if it's really just the fault of these politicians, then where are all the other bright people of conscience? Where are all the bright, honest, intelligent Americans ready to step in and save the nation and lead the way? We don't have people like that in this country. Everybody's at the mall, scratching his ass, picking his nose, taking his credit card out of his fanny pack and buying a pair of sneakers with lights in them. So I have solved this little political dilemma for myself in a very simple way. On election day, I stay home.
Just a push of a button. Just a
touch of a screen. Welcome to the future. Come try our voting machine.
Electronic voting machine.
We wrote the software, tighten the bolts, built these machines so we could generate results. The hope is flawless, it's guaranteed. Once we are certain of the outcome that we need, no hanging chance now.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
I disagree with George. There's too much at stake to stay on the couch this time. These elections may be corrupt, but the stakes could be the planet. That is where young voters are needed by the millions because, my friends, it is your future we are using up. In the United States, there is a new movement to develop the power of green voting. It's called Power Vote, and we have spokesperson Brianna K. O'Cotter on the line. From Colorado, we have Brianna K. O'Cotter, Communications Director for Energy Action Coalition and a spokeswoman for a new push in the American election debate called PowerVote.org. Well, Brianna, like many people, I've been kind of frustrated to find this looming crisis of climate change being pushed to the back of the election agenda of both parties. We hardly hear about it, even as these big storms and droughts pummel parts of America. What's happening to change that?
Well, young people in America share your frustration because what we see is politicians gambling with our future by refusing to seriously and boldly address the challenges and opportunities posed by the global climate crisis. So the young people that I work with have formed a powerful campaign moving forward through the election called Power Vote, where we have the aim of getting 1 million young American climate voters pledged to voting for clean and just energy in this election, and also really organizing and pushing to make sure that candidates up and down the ballot, not just at the presidential level, but at the local level as well and the state level, are putting forward bold policies for green job creation, for moratoriums on coal, for re-engagement in the international community in addressing climate change. And we're joining together as a powerful voting constituency in this election. Young people, millennial voters like myself, are set to represent a quarter of the electorate in the election on November 4th. And when we go to the polls on November 4th in record-breaking numbers, we're going there and we are voting with our values, with on issues like clean energy, like a strong commitment to improving our health, ending future wars, and all the rest of the things that we see as intimately connected to our current addiction to a petroleum pollution-based economy and the desperate need we see to immediately move America off of dirty energy and towards a clean energy future.
Well, I think those are fantastic goals, and it has to happen. I was surprised somewhat that on September 12th, you hosted a conference with journalists with renowned NASA scientist James Hansen. Mm-hmm. How did you arrange that, and what was the media reaction?
Dr. James Hansen, as many of your listeners, I'm sure, know, a world-renowned premier climate scientist, is a strong supporter of the Energy Action Coalition and our Power Vote campaign. I mean, as a scientist who has been studying and sounding the warning call for global warming for decades now, he knows more than any of us why we must take immediate action on climate change and is as frustrated as any of us to see continued political stalemates and inaction and greenwashing. And so when we asked him to join our press conference launch of Power Vote, he was more than willing to join us. And, you know, one of the things that he said in that call, and he was also joined by some of the youth leaders in our movement, who are working for green jobs in Chester, Pennsylvania, or working in Tennessee to shut down new nuclear plants. And he, you know, he joined these youth leaders and said, you know, the politicians are gambling with your future right now. And this is exactly the sort of political push that we need. We need to see voters, young and old, showing up in record numbers in this election and really demanding bold action on climate change. And, yeah.
Well, are you working exclusively with the Democratic Party, or is this a nonpartisan thing? Are you working on Republican candidates to get their commitments going? What's the story?
Absolutely, Alex. This is a nonpartisan campaign. We need political leadership up and down the ballot. No candidates are saying what are proposing what we really need to see on climate change today. So, you know, even when we hear Obama speak and McCain speak, they're both talking and perpetuating a clean coal mythology. Both of them are talking about nuclear energy. And when we're defining a clean and just energy future that is good for us and good for our future and good for our communities and good for our health, it does not include clean, so, you know, quote unquote clean coal or nuclear. And also really demands much deeper cuts in our emissions and on, really. Like, we need political leadership that goes far beyond what any candidate is saying today.
Well, isn't it amazing to watch the television coverage? There's so much about personalities and so little about the economic situation, which is dire, and the climate situation. Even as this big storm, you know, last week, Galveston Island totally closed off, hurricanes washing over. And yet, what are we hearing? We're hearing about Sarah Palin, who, in fact, is a climate science denier. She says global warming's just a scam.
Yeah, it's horrifying, really. You know, it's insulting that the media and the political elite think that, you know, young voters in particular are more interested about where a candidate gets their hair styled than what their positions on energy and healthcare and the war in Iraq and issues that really impact our lives very directly are. And, you know, Power Vote, which we're working on, is but one of literally hundreds of youth voter engagement projects that are happening in the United States right now. You know, mobilizing Latino young voters, mobilizing young voters who are veterans of the Iraq War, and on and on. Pretty much any issue you can imagine, it's young people mobilizing, registering, getting out the vote in record numbers. And it's not because of the candidates. It's not because of cool technology, as many of the, you know, kind of political and media elite would have you believe. It really is because we understand what is at stake in the U.S. election. On November 4th, when we go to the polls, it's our future at stake. And we need to, we need to address serious issues in this country much more than we need to address where a candidate gets their hair styled.
Well, some things do slip through. The Washington Post published an op-ed piece lately from the Brookings Institute. It was titled 7 Minutes to Climate Midnight, and they pointed out that whoever wins must begin drastic action from day one, because we've only got till about, well, maybe 2015 at the latest. But do you see enough public support? Or are people just thinking about their own jobs and their own lives enough to see what's happening here with our climate? The Arctic's melting.
Yeah, you know, absolutely, I think we see massive public support. Once you start really talking to people and engaging them on these issues, people do care, and they understand how addressing the climate crisis also means addressing the economic crisis in America. You know, young people in my generation face the lowest standard of living in this country. We stand to face a lower standard of living than our parents' generation, which is the first time that's ever happened. And we see that by seriously investing in quite frankly, a clean energy revolution in this country, which, as you suggest, needs to happen very quickly, that we will also create millions of good domestic jobs, weatherizing homes, putting solar panels on roofs, building wind farms, all of the things that we need to really switch our energy choices over to clean energy that will help evade, you know, a full-on climate catastrophe, are also the same solutions that will help get us out of this economic disaster that we're in right now, taking the billions of dollars that we're currently throwing into wars and into subsidizing the oil and nuclear and coal industry can be reinvested in job creation, in clean energy solutions, in job training programs for people in our education and our healthcare and helping us build better communities. So, you know, I think that when you talk to people about how the energy choices our country makes directly impact, you know, the economy and health and other issues that impact them on a daily basis, people absolutely get it. We're seeing our numbers for the Power Vote Pledge jump from 2,000 to 102,000 in less than 2 weeks. Absolutely, we see public support for this. It's you know, everywhere the students on the ground that are running Power Vote campaigns say that it's, you know, they're having 150 people show up at their first meetings, and everybody wants to sign the Power Vote Pledge, and they go in and do a presentation to a class, and the whole class signs it at the end. So, you know, I think public opinion is definitely much farther ahead of where politicians are right now on clean energy issues in the United States.
Well, darn it, you're giving me hope. I hate that. Well, why don't you tell us about powervote.org and what you want people to do and where they go and what kind of commitment are you looking for?
Great. You know, we're looking for people as a first step to go to powervote.org, sign the Power Vote Pledge, become one of our 1 million young voters committed to clean and just energy in this election. But what we really need is for people to stay involved beyond November 4th and to moving forward to make sure that in the first 100 days of the new administration, creating bold, clean, and just energy policies is a top priority, and that whatever small promises have been made on the campaign trail actually become a reality. And in the places where our candidates all need to be pushed, in rejecting the clean coal mythology, in rejecting nuclear energy and taking away subsidies for the dirty energy industries and putting them into clean energy, politicians aren't going to do that on their own. They have powerful lobbyists in the dirty energy industry that are pushing that agenda forward, and what we need is an uprising. We need all of those 1 million people that signed the Power Vote Pledge to show up and demand real action in the first 100 days of the new administration and moving forward. And you can find out about all of that. You can see photos. You can read the media. You can read blog updates and exciting, you know, reports from the field of people running Power Vote. All on powervote.org.
Well, this is really happening, and I'm so glad. We've been talking with Brianna Kale Cotter, who's with the Energy Action Coalition, and right now she's a spokeswoman for a real new youth movement called powervote.org. Thank you so much, Brianna.
Thank you so much, Alex.
On their conference call for journalists, Power Vote had a very distinguished guest. Top NASA scientist James Hansen renewed his call for young people to demand climate action before it's too late. Let's go to Canada, where another widely based coalition is trying to translate climate concern into real political action. Here's a speech by the well-known forest activist, Zipporah Berman, as she helps launch Power Up Canada on September 10th.
I'm fighting global warming.
And I'm fighting global warming.
But the fact is, despite our efforts, global warming is getting worse. And we need our government to pass stronger laws and policies.
Only government can force big companies to change and make sure all Canadians pay their fair share.
You can't fight global warming alone.
But now you don't have to.
Together, we can send a powerful message to our federal leaders. So sign up now and join thousands of other Canadians working together to power up our voice.
Power up our future.
And power up Canada.
My name is Zipporah Berman. I'm the Executive Director of Power Up Canada. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. You can find that video on our new website, powerupcanada.ca, which went live 5 minutes ago, and also there are copies in your press packages. There are moments in history when citizens from all walks of life need to come together to work for change. Moments when the threats we face unite us with a common purpose. Moments that require strong leadership, and our elected leaders to hear that we will stand for nothing less. The growing threat of global warming and the impacts we're already seeing in rising food costs, in rising energy costs, in threats to national security, water scarcity, in the dramatic rise that we're all seeing in our daily lives in violent storms, presents us with one of these moments. We know that Canadians care about global warming. Across the country, we are all trying to do our part. We're changing our light bulbs. We're walking to work. We're retrofitting our homes. Yet Canada's emissions are projected to increase, not to decrease. This isn't a problem that individuals can solve alone. We know that there's no question that it's important for us to change our light bulbs. But today we're here to say that it is even more important to change our laws, to protect our children, and ensure Canada becomes a leader in the fight against global warming. Today we're here because we want to encourage all parties to work together to ensure that we have dramatic investments in clean energy and renewables, strong laws and policies, and support strong international agreements. We know that global warming is the overriding issue of our times. The science is clear that we need to do everything we can to reduce global warming pollution fast. On this point, all parties in this election agree. The question that remains is, will Canada's global warming emissions go down? Will the candidates pledge to pass strong laws and policies to make this happen? We know that Canada has an incredibly poor performance on global warming. We know that China has stronger vehicle emission efficiency standards than Canada does. Our ranking is at the very bottom of global performance. We have weaker laws and policies than almost every other large industrialized country. Power Up Canada is a new vision of the future in which Canada moves quickly to become a leader in fighting global warming, to invest in clean energy in a clean energy future that benefits all Canadians. Across the board, we know that Canadians want stronger laws to harness the market and reduce emissions. Yesterday, I'm sure many of you heard, five of Canada's former prime ministers, leading business leaders, climate scientists, and policy experts came together to issue their call for action. Today, in launching Power Up, we are joined in support by the Canadian Association for the 45 Plus, also known as CARP. We're supported today by the Canadian Jewish Congress. And you'll see in your press packet the head of the Canada's largest Indo-Canadian association, the Steelworkers Union, business leaders from some of Canada's most important industries. This is truly a national initiative. Power Up Canada is partnered in Quebec with Équiterre, who will be coordinating the campaign in Quebec. Why are so many disparate groups of people coming together? The threat to us and our children and our country is now too obvious to ignore, and our federal leaders are not getting the job done. This is a lack of political leadership at the highest levels from both the right and the left. So far, we've seen our elected leaders and all the political parties jockey for position on climate change. They're putting each other down. They're arguing that the one piece they've hung their hat on is the ultimate answer. We need collaboration in government. We need leadership from the right and the left to ensure that we reduce global warming pollution fast. We cannot allow climate to become a partisan tennis ball in this election. We deserve stronger leadership than that. So today we're calling on all politicians to talk to Canadians like adults, to drop the schoolyard brawl over cap and trade versus tax shifting, because we know that leading jurisdictions are using both taxes and regulations to get the job done. All of us are waiting to hear what the parties promise for Canada moving forward. We have some idea of some of the parties' plans and are eager to hear from others what they promise to do. Once we hear from all parties, we'll be summarizing the promises for Canadians so that all citizens can see how well they advance a new vision for Canada. We'll be holding public events. We'll be mobilizing Canadians across the country, a network of concerned citizens through new media. We're not naive. We know that the parties have to duke it out in the course of the election, but we intend for them to hear loud and clear that the next parliament has got to get things done. And when they go back to Ottawa, we'll be holding them accountable to find a nonpartisan way forward towards a better vision for Canada. Today, we're also releasing a new poll by Harris Decima that you can find in your press packages. This polling data shows very clearly that Canadians want Canada to do more, and they don't see it in conflict with the economy, but as a way to modernize our economy. A few of the poll highlights that no party has convinced a majority of Canadians that they have the answers. For a solid majority, 67%, global warming is an important issue or one of the most important voting issues. Canadians are clearly hearing that other countries are modernizing their economies and creating jobs with stronger global warming laws. Fully 73% of Canadians from across this country believe that stronger laws will improve our economy. Today, we're seeing record profits for big oil companies at our expense. High gas prices are all the more reason for clean cars. Trouble in manufacturing is all the more reason to ramp up clean technology. Canada is brimming with opportunities in carbon sequestration and renewable energy. Power Up Canada is supported by a growing list of concerned Canadians across the country. And since the news started breaking yesterday of our initiative, our phones have been ringing off the hook, with individuals from across the country wanting to join Power Up. Some of the people from coast to coast who have joined Power Up, names that you'll know already, prominent supporters now include Canadian Olympian Adam Creek, gold medalist at the Beijing Olympics, Canadian actors Rachel McAdams, Kiefer Sutherland, Neve Campbell, Charles Martin Smith, Professor Thomas Homer Dixon, Clayton Ruby, Michael Ndonche, Margaret Atwood, Anne-Marie McDonald, designer Evan Bedell, Moses Neimer, and many more. Sending their regrets today because they could not join us at the press conference, but you'll see in your press packages that they have provided statements. Dr. Joseph Wong, the founding national president of the Chinese-Canadian National Council. Kashmir Dhaliwal, the president of the Khalsa Daiwan Society, North America's largest Sikh association. And Avram Lazar from the Forest Products Association of Canada. I want to introduce to you now Dr. Matthew Bramley from the Pembina Institute, also the policy advisor from Power Up Canada, who will tell you a little bit about both our policy recommendations and the questions that we're releasing today to candidates.
That was Zipporah Berman speaking on September 10th in Toronto at the launch of the Power Up Canada rally. Things are looking up a bit for Canadians now that Green Party head Elizabeth May will be allowed into the leaders' debates on television. Someone to speak for the environment in a national election. Imagine that. Meanwhile, the world's top scientists have said the next few years will determine whether we can keep the climate humans have always known. The Global Carbon Project has released a report saying human carbon dioxide emissions grew about four times faster since the year 2000 than during the 1990s. And in case you missed it, scientist Örjan Gustafsson of Stockholm University in Sweden has just reported from a Soviet scientific expedition that methane gas is leaking from under the sea off the coast of Siberia. Exactly the doomsday scenario our best scientists have worried about. The newspaper The Independent in Britain said they received an email from Gustafsson on the Russian research ship Jakov Smirninsky, saying, quote, "An extensive area of intense methane release was found. At earlier sites, we have found elevated levels of dissolved methane. Yesterday, for the first time, we documented a field where the release was so intense that the methane did not have time to dissolve into the seawater, but was rising as methane bubbles to the sea surface. These methane chimneys were documented on echo sounders and with seismic instruments." End quote. Experts in Europe have cautioned that the latest results haven't been peer-reviewed about this methane, and it hasn't been published yet, but this is one alarming development, and it could move fast. Keep your eye on it. Methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. There's plenty of it, stored in the Arctic permafrost, which is melting as temperatures there rise dramatically. There is even more methane frozen under the sea. They're called clathrates. Some scientists say if these clathrates start to melt, the methane burst would punch us into a crazy new climate within a few years' time. Well, here's a thought. Instead of spending money on a mission to Mars, maybe we should get a whole fleet of research ships up to the Arctic to find out whether the methane really is escaping. If it is, that changes the whole world game plan. Meanwhile, all you and I can do is to cut our carbon emissions as low as possible to keep the Arctic from melting and vote for politicians who promise to protect the climate. I found these stories at Ross Gilbspan's site, heatisonline.org.
We live in a country in which a person cannot get elected president if he openly doubts the existence of heaven and hell. This is truly remarkable. Given that there is no other body of knowledge that we require our political leaders to master, Even a hairstylist must pass a licensing exam before plying his trade in the United States. And yet those given the power to make war and national policy, those whose decisions will inevitably affect human life for generations, are not expected to know anything in particular before starting to work. They do not have to be political scientists, economists, or even lawyers. They need not have studied international relations, military history, resource management, civil engineering, or any other field of knowledge that might be brought to bear in the governance of a modern superpower. They need only be expert fundraisers, comport themselves well on television, and be indulgent of certain myths.
America's more affordable than ever. Just $19. Now you can get the all-new powerful, strong, sexy, affordable, great, easy, new extreme. Simple, unrivaled, effective, special, no money down today.
I want to thank my listener friend in Colorado for some of today's clips. Find his red-hot voting primer at radioforall.net. Another listener from New Zealand tells me the ozone hole is bigger than ever in the Antarctic, and people are being warned in New Zealand daily about the high risks of skin cancer. Apparently the Montreal Protocol has a few holes in it too, as this problem is far from solved. One of our previous guests, Anthony Marr, is off on his Future Submerged Cities tour, asking mayors of threatened cities to boycott dirty energy from Canada's tar sands. Keep up with that at www.youtube.com/AnthonyMarr, spelled M-A-R-R. And wrapping up, last night I heard a powerful speech by Paul Ehrlich, author of The Population Bomb and a zillion other books. I'm working on getting that audio for you, dear listener, on a coming Radio EcoShock show. You can write me with tips, radio@ecoshock.org, and visit our website for tons of free audio, MP3 downloads, all the green info you can handle at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Thank you for listening. Here's Jimmy Cliff with a special message for Wall Street.